Chick for listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast, where this week we will be spoiling for everyone the A-Team. I have with me Christian McClansky. Hello, Christian.
McClansky. That's, yeah, that's former McClansky.
All right. Also, Kelly Wan. Kelly Wan, do you have an A-Team-oriented tagline for us this week?
Contact rear.
All right, good.
They kept saying that over and over, and it was never in a scene with Jessica Biel. They were never referencing Jessica Biel. They kept saying contact.
Now, I realize this is very plot.
What's that music?
That's Jimi Hendrix, a little Crosstown Traffic. I have no idea. I can't explain why I played this A-Team podcast, but it seems
a little. Well, I see you could have come up with something pretty meticulous there, and I would have believed you.
Yeah, I got nothing.
Instead, now I think they're all that lazy, and you never think about it.
I thought that, what I do is I just go through iTunes on random, and when something strikes me, I play that. And I just thought Crosstown Traffic was spirited and energetic and from an earlier time.
That's infinitely more thought than I thought you put into it.
Okay.
I tracked what I said about it being totally improvised.
Just like this movie, spirited, energetic, from an earlier time.
Thank you, Dingus.
Contact rear.
Kelly, since it's such a plot-heavy movie, a lot depends on the events of the movie. Why don't you recount the plot of the A-Team for us?
Oh, man. All right. It's pretty convoluted, so try and bear with me. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So Qui-Gon is this Irish dude named Hannibal. who smokes cigars that he never lights, and he loves it when a plan comes together, and he's on the jazz. And he carjacks Mr. T and shoots him in the arm, so Mr. T becomes his friend. And the hangover guy, Face, is about to get burned alive, but the money has a microphone in it, and he says Alpha Foxtrot, so Hannibal knows where to jump the car and save him. And they all have Army Rangers tattoos. And the District 9 guy has one, so they all become a covert ops team in Baghdad for the Simon and Simon guy, who's their friend, but he sets them up. She gets Jessica Biel demoted. But then some guy busts them out of prison, like a different guy who set them up, and Biel wants to catch Face because he ruined her career, but then he kisses her and handcuffs her so she knows he's innocent. And they get away in a plane, and then they almost kill Biel on the runway so she knows they're innocent. And then they survived missiles exploding their plane by being instantly inside a tank that was inside it that didn't blow up and has a parachute on it. And they landed on some dude's head while he's fishing in Germany. And then they ask his widow which way to Berlin. And she laughed when her husband got killed because he thinks he's so clever with his dynamite. It stays lit underwater. So she helps him out. Some more stuff blows up. They go to the port of L.A. A bunch of CGI containers get thrown around. Mr. T learns to kill again because he likes Gandhi. So he gets his mohawk back because Gandhi. And they get arrested again. But Biel luckily has a bobby pin in her mouth, like at the beginning of this conversation, before she finds out they're arrested. So then she kisses Faceman again so they can cause more comical havoc and get fired again. The end.
Because of Gandhi.
Yeah, Gandhi. She learns to bobby pin again.
Except it was a key, but it was because of Gandhi.
I think I left out some stuff, but I think I zoned out a lot after the helicopter part.
That was actually remarkably close to what the script, like what a pitch must have really looked like to someone actually describing the plot of this movie.
Why did you guys last week try to tell me Joe Carnahan was awesome? I forget.
Because of Narc, because of certain scenes in Smokin' Aces, and I maintain because of A-Team.
And I also maintain...
No, not having a word. Nope. It's a trick. Tom's tricking us.
Dingus?
Sorry, Dingus. What?
Go ahead.
I also maintain because of The Ticker.
The Ticker?
That's right.
So that's a movie or a short he did or...
Yeah, it's a short he did. And that's the reason Joe Carnahan, I always think of him based on that, and I can never really place what the heck that is, and finally I refigured it out. And yeah,
Now, what is the ticker? Because I know that he did an indie movie called like Bullets, High Octane, and some other thing, which I never saw. But the ticker is something that predated that.
The ticker is one of eight films in a series of films called The Hire.
Oh, good Lord. Dingus, those aren't films. They're commercials.
Yeah, and it's a damn good commercial.
Which one? Junior, the film, Best Picture, 2001.
Now, go ahead and finish, Dingus. Which one is the ticker? Because I've seen most of these.
The ticker is the Don Cheadle one.
Oh, maybe I haven't seen that one. And these are BMW commercials.
Exactly. Yeah.
Why don't you tell us what happens in the ticker?
All right. The guy from Simon & Simon is not in the ticker. Neither is the guy from Magnum P.I., which is a shame. But like Magnum P.I., a guy drives a convertible, and he's the guy from The Croupier. And the croupier guy has to drive Don Cheadle to a destination, and Don Cheadle has a bleeding briefcase. And if he doesn't get Don Cheadle to his destination before a gigantic helicopter shoots them, then somebody's going to die and the world is going to end.
Now, Dingus, why would you characterize that particular BMW commercial as the Don Cheadle one instead of the Clive Owen one?
Because Clive Owen was in all of them.
Racist. So what I'm getting at here, and I really did quite enjoy the A-Team, is I think Joe Carnahan knows how to string together an action sequence.
No, he does not. You are so wrong on that. How dare you say that?
Okay.
You really believe that? Because that was my least favorite thing about the movie was the action.
Well, part of it, I would maintain that there aren't a lot of – the action sequences in A-Team aren't really action sequences so much as – and I don't know if this is from the TV show, because one thing I realized watching the movie is that I don't remember the TV show, so I don't think I ever watched it. But they're not so much action sequences as plans coming together, as they're little mini heists that are spun out, and they might have a little action in them. But the whole idea is these guys do these elaborate, goofy plots, and as they're talking about them, we concurrently see them unfolding and happening. And they're not conventional action sequences like they were, for instance, in Smoke and Aces. Smoke and Aces had this awesome sniper scene set in a hotel. I think in A-Team, it's not about the action, it's about the plan.
And that's your defense of him as an action director, is that it's not about the action. It's like saying Lost was about the characters, and therefore what happened to them in Purgatory.
Well, what I'm saying is he there's a lot of expensive action sequences shot, and he knows how to use the footage to make it engaging. I enjoyed all of the action stuff in this movie.
All of it.
But yeah, whether it was CG or just big things with fireworks at the L.A. port and some SUVs driving zigzags or... the tank on the parachute. I loved all that stuff. Yeah, absolutely. And I thought it was built nicely into the movie. Yep.
I think you're tricking us. I think these were the most incoherent action sequences I've ever seen in any movie since The Specialist. I had no sense of spatial awareness. I didn't understand anything that was going on. I was half asleep, but like. To give an example, Liam Neeson at one point, okay, they cut the debriefings with the actual things going on, like you said, and one of his lines in the debriefing is, "Don't worry, in case of snipers, I'll be up here or something." And he's on top of he goes down a guy wire onto the truck.
Right, a zip line onto the truck, right.
That's his plan for snipers? What the hell's that mean? He's telling this to the guy who's going to be under the truck. He's going to be the one getting sniped.
I don't know, I mean, what I got from that is... A, it looks really cool to have a guy ride a zip line onto a truck, and B, the excuse for that is he's going to cover to watch out for snipers before jumping into the fray. I mean, all of it, Kelly Wand, is just an excuse to have things like Liam Neeson riding a zip line.
These Dingus, which of us is high on this?
I don't think you need me.
Because I've never disagreed with Tom. All right, Batty, but okay, let me rephrase that. On this issue, because I've never thought he was more insane than he's been in the last 5 minutes. I think he's lost his mind. I can't believe like the action scenes in the A-Team.
Before Dingus weighs in and resolves this, let me relate this to another movie that I really, really like that everybody normally hates that this reminded me of, and that is McGee's Charlie's Angels movies. Those movies are, in a way, they're just crap. They're just music video crap spliced together with attractive chicks doing fun stuff. But I love the action in those movies because I love how vivid how the characters just have their own little moments and their own style, and they just mix them all together in these really energetic action sequences. And I felt the same way about A-Team that I feel about the Charlie's Angels movies, is we're just watching these actors having a lot of fun. They're very present in the scenes, and the action is shot very energetically. And I couldn't have cared less that I really didn't have much idea what was going on or why they were doing certain things. It was just so energetic that I thought it was great, and I'm going to say this, I thought it was great fun. So I felt the same way about A-Team as I did about the Charlie's Angels movies.
The Charlie's Angels movies look like Guns of Navarone compared to this movie.
Well, like, the Charlie's Angels movies, to be fair, they had, wasn't it Wu Ping? Didn't they have like the Matrix choreographer? You know,
yeah.
Their choreography was very different. The choreography in A-Team was much more just splicing together, you know, Liam Neeson on a zip line. It wasn't nearly as coherent. You talk about not having a sense of place, and I agree. They're cartoony action sequences. I mean, it's absurd, ridiculous stuff that makes.
I don't mind that. And the Charlie's Angels, in the opening sequence of the second Charlie's Angels movie,
yep,
where they're like
the helicopter
flying down, and the explosion blows her. I like that because I get that they don't care. But in the A-Team, I never was convinced that they didn't care in a fun way like the Charlie's Angels.
Come on, they do the very same stunt in the A-Team with Charlton Copley flying the helicopter. You know, where he stalls out the helicopter.
He does it twice. He does the same thing twice.
And they're having a grand old time. The actors were. I thought it was very energetic, and I loved it. I liked it. I quite liked it. It wasn't.
Oh.
I really liked the movie. For the same reason. Now, why do you hate? Why do you not like this, but you do like Charlie's Angels?
Because Charlie's Angels was clearly a goof, and this. This was, I think we were meant to think that this could actually happen. Like, there's just enough gravitas.
You know, here, Kelly Wand is where I think, and Dingus, I promise we'll get you in here in a minute, because you're going to be the tiebreaker here. Here, Kelly Wand is where I think it's very clear that we're not supposed to think any of this is real. And that's early on in the scene where Hannibal is introduced. And we see him getting beat up, and he's about to get shot, but they say, you know, no, use his gun. And he does the whole stunt with a firing pin, and the dogs disappear into the darkness. And then they come out whining, and their collars are handcuffed together. That right there was like a cartoon scene. It was a goof. And for contrast, think of I was reminded as I was watching it of the scene with Josh Brolin in No Country for Old Men, where he's got a malfunctioning gun and a Rottweiler running out at him. And that scene in No Country for Old Men is a very different kind of tension than what we got here in the opening of A-Team, where we introduce Hannibal Smith. So to me, nothing. It was a goof all along. And I got that, to me, seemed like it was established very early on.
I love what you're saying, but I couldn't make that leap. I wish I had, because when I think about it, when I think about the tank scene, it seems like such a great idea on paper, and so does like when the 3D, when the van crashes through the wall, and they're all wearing 3D glasses, yeah, like in Bachelor Party. That conceptually makes great sense to me. It sounds awesome, mm-hmm, which is what the A stands for, but...
Stick to your guns, Kelly Wand. Don't.
There's a lot of serious talk in this movie, and there's a lot of like scenes of like, oh, Gerald McCraney betrayed us. Oh, and he's the. There's a lot of solid solemnity in this that ruins what you're talking about. And Charlie's Angels had none of that. There was never a scene in Charlie's Angels where we go, oh, dude, I really care about this computer chip.
Now, you know, there is. I don't know if you remember this, Kelly Wand. There's a scene in Charlie's Angels where you think Bosley's dead. Do you remember that? Serious. The house blows up, and they think... Now, I agree with you, it's a little different, but Charlie's Angels would every now and then try to get serious. Not very, but okay, I am pushing
it. Let Dingus talk.
All right, Dingus, who...
I'm going to go insane if I listen to you.
All right, Dingus, get in here.
Dingus is the voice of reason, and be careful what you say next, Dingus.
What movie are we talking about? I'm sorry, I've been reading.
I'm scared, too, because he was the one who was talking about how awesome the BMW commercial was. So I'm scared now.
Yep.
I'm really scared.
All right, here's a line from what I wrote in my notes.
God.
Let me try to figure out which one of you is high. I'm trying to. All right, here's a line from what I wrote in my notes. Dear the losers, Robin Hood and Prince of Persia, suck it.
No.
Because Kelly Wan says this has the least coherent action sequences of any movies he's seen since, I don't know, Casablanca or something. But the action in this movie and this movie altogether is filmed with so much more competence than so many of the films we've had to see recently. And I don't normally watch these movies, and I don't normally get the opportunity to. And what's awesome about doing this podcast is I get to see a movie a week right now. And this was such a breath of fresh air after seeing movies like that over the last few weeks. It was sorry, Kelly Wan, but so much better filming and so much more coherent action-wise, and as absurd as it was, and I totally disagree that it had any sense of seriousness about it whatsoever. Just the fact that the MacGuffin is engraving plates instead of some sort of WMD or something. I mean, engraving plates really makes it just totally absurd. I mean, as soon as you see the helicopter do a barrel roll, which is possible. I mean, helicopters can fly upside down, but once you see helicopters doing barrel rolls, you know you're in for just complete absurdity, and that was fine. I had a fantastic time seeing this movie.
There you go, Kelly Wand. You are the odd man out.
You both sicken me.
Well, now let's do a podcast where we try to win you over, Kelly Wand.
No.
But come on, you admit that you liked the 3D glasses gimmick. How inspired was that? Because here's the deal, Kelly Wand. That whole scene is about watching it going, what? Why are there 3D glasses? What is this? What is Charlton Copley doing?
So to you, it was like a Cannonball Run movie. Like, it was working for you on that level. It was that retarded.
Well, I really don't remember or know Cannonball Run that well. So for me, it really was about, okay, it was about, okay, look, here's something that's a little crazy. Why are they showing us this? Why are there 3D glasses? You know, what is this weird 80s movie that they're watching? And then the Jeep comes busting through the wall, and you're like, oh, that's what that is. And there's a payoff. All of these goofy, crazy scenes have a payoff. When they need a magnet and the airbags, I'm like, what? Why do they want those? And there's a payoff for that stuff. That right there makes it instantly, to me, more competent than the things Dingus listed that we've had to sit through this summer so far. You know, where was that kind of payoff in Robin Hood or Prince of Persia or The Losers?
No, in The Losers, there's tons of that. The Losers is the rich man's A-team.
Now, The Losers have, now I've got a crossbow, bitch. You know, Chris Evans shows up with a crossbow and he shoots it. That's not payoff. That's out of left field. You know, here you're left wondering, why 3D glasses? Why do you want a magnet? Why are we stealing the side of a car door? You know, all that stuff I felt was a little mystery. And you get in the context of the spirited action scene, you get a solution to the mystery. And what it all comes down to is, hey, these guys, they're having fun and they're really smart. And that instantly right there makes them more likable to me than any of the losers. The losers, for instance, if you want to talk about a movie that thinks it's being solemn and that thinks it has some gravity, you know, look at that whole first 20 minutes of The Losers. They don't do any of that here. These guys fall in love with each other because they all have the same tattoo, you know? It's just instant shorthand for this, you know, that sort of deepest foundation of manly love, and that's military service.
We're supposed to salute the screen when that happens, though. Not giggle.
You know what, though? It is so... I mean, you really feel that was reverent? I mean, to me, it was just shorthand.
What's the music? No. It's supposed to make you go, maybe Iraq wasn't a good idea. When they're in Baghdad and everything goes wrong and all the dollar bills are floating down, you're supposed to go, yeah, I don't know, maybe Bush was bad.
But no, I never thought any of that, because what they're talking about is dollar bills. Dollar bills, y'all. They're not talking about lives. They're talking about dollar bills. And that's what this movie is about. This movie is about dollar bills, and not even dollar bills. It's not like saving dollar bills. It's about saving engraving plates, which I don't even know what that is. I haven't known what that is since watching The In-Laws, and I don't care.
It's a counterfeiting MacGuffin.
It is, and it's the perfect MacGuffin because it, my first reaction is to think engraving plates, really, that's all you could come up with, and then the next second I'm like, oh good, engraving plates. I don't care about engraving plates. Does anybody? And they're all chasing engraving plates. Who cares? It's not a human life. It's not a baby. It's not a WMD. It's not a nuke. It's not it's not biological weapons or something that could have any sort of tragic implications. It's engraving plates. And I love that development in this. I love that. And, you know, talking about the losers, what I think about and why I like this so much more is just thinking of B.A. Baracus shooting that long-range mortar or whatever he's shooting, this grenade into the building across the way, instead of that other guy doing the sniper rifle into the building from far away. And instead of him being a punchline, he's a part of the action sequence. It's just well integrated. Everything that happens action-wise to me, even when it's absurd, is well integrated in this. And that's why I had such a great time and really liked it. Now, you know, Tom, you've already admitted that you have no experience with the television series whatsoever.
You know what? And I realized that watching this, because I only knew about the thing where B.A. doesn't like to fly and they have to drug him from our friend Len telling me about this. So there were other things as I was watching that I was wondering, oh, is that a nod to the TV show? And it made me realize, wow, I must have never watched that. So, yeah.
Kelly, did you have any experience with the A-Team?
Yeah, and I liked this show. I thought it was great.
Well, what did you like
MacGyver,
about it?
MacGyver.
Exactly.
Hannibal was on the Jazz, and I liked the qualities you guys are praising. To me, was in the show, but it wasn't in the movie. The retardation, the love of retardation, and just I don't know. To me, it seemed funnier in the show. Maybe it was the cast. Maybe to me, there's something about Liam Neeson to me that doesn't suggest badassness.
Have you seen Taken, by the way?
No, because his wife died, and I didn't want to see it. I felt bummed for him. But also Mr. T to me is like he's irreplaceable. Like in
Kelly Wand, you're too in love with the source material, aren't you?
I am. Yeah, you heard me. A-Team TV shows too good to film. But in this movie, remember when Mr. T says, "I can't kill no more," or the Mr. T surrogate, and then 3 minutes later they're like running over that dude in the toll booth, and he's all, "Sorry, dude." And then they're like shooting missiles.
Yeah. Now, is that from the TV show, this idea that Mr. T is a pacifist?
I think so. And by the way, Mr. T in RL is mad at this movie and talking shit about it because he says it's too sexy and violent.
Well, he actually
the show's about the kids.
He walked that back because he hasn't seen it. I mean, I've read some of that too, and he didn't. He's the one guy who didn't appear in it who's alive.
The other guys weren't George Peppard and Dirk Benedict.
Dirk Benedict always hates though. Like he was like, "Oh, new Battlestar Galactica, girl playing me." It's ridiculous.
Is he in the movie?
Yeah. Dirk Benedict and Dwight.
Oh, Dwight Schultz. True.
Yeah.
No.
Dwight Schultz does. Both of them appear in the button at the end, but of course George Peppard cannot since he has, departed.
Wait, what button at the end?
Do you watch credits?
Oh, for Pete's sake. Oh, did I miss something at the... Oh, rats. Okay.
Yes, I did too.
What did we miss, Dingus?
You missed their two cameos after the credits.
Goofy. Why did they... What kind of crappy cameo do you save for after credits?
Yeah.
Well, they are crappy cameos, but they are cameos.
Hey, after the credits, there's an Easter egg?
Oh, yeah.
That's a terrible place to put a cameo because nobody's going to see it.
Yeah, well, I saw it, and half my theater did because a lot of people stayed. Not you jerks.
Well, I'll just look
did your audience like it? Because my audience just seemed like bored and dumb.
My audience was nuts for it. They were going crazy.
Really?
Yeah, they were loving it.
Torrance sucks. Maybe that's what ruined it for me. Maybe if everyone had been cheering her, I would have gone, well, can't argue with that.
There was a kid in my audience. I think he must have been, I don't know, he might have been 12 or 13. Of course, he had to go to the bathroom two or three times during the damn film. But he exclaimed that it was the funnest film he's ever seen. He also said, "Wow!" After the betrayal well, one of the many betrayals after Patrick Wilson's betrayal when the
so he was following the plot that closely, like he actually recognized Gerald McRaney with like the wig on and like, oh
yeah, which was weird because that's generally a Hannibal thing. The costumes thing is a Hannibal thing.
Yeah.
Oh, he would do costume. Because I knew instant. I mean, I even when they're talking, I'm not generally very smart about movie plots, but I knew instant, once they talked about this mysterious Arab, I knew the general was the Arab.
Like that. Yeah, because he's the only marquee member who's not doing anything.
Right, exactly, yeah.
But I'm surprised, Kelly, that you are a fan of the show and that you didn't really, really like this, because it gets a lot of the stuff of the show. What exactly you said, that it pre-MacGyvered MacGyver. It has that whole, we're a bunch of dudes who are sweaty and we're welding a bunch of stuff. And and also that wonderful, and I thought there were two sequences that I thought were wonderfully edited in this. And one of those is that Baghdad attack sequence where it's all, this is what we're going to do, and they're doing all the little models while we intercut the actual scene, the actual action scene. And so you lose some of the punch of the action scene, but you get all of what's going on with the characters, and it totally worked for me. And then the betrayal at the end has more of a kick, I think. And I really loved the way that was edited. And I think that's very much of a piece of how the show worked. It was a TV show that couldn't afford to be brutal and violent beyond a certain point and couldn't afford people dying. So it had absurd shootouts and car wrecks and flying vehicles and explosions and nobody ever dying. And these guys always coming out, you know, somebody got shot in the arm or the leg, but they would be healed by next week. And so I thought the film really got that sort of television sensibility without being a TV movie. And it didn't appeal to you.
No, because they were just all, there was just too much braggadocio. Like Hannibal's the braggadocio one, but in this they were all like cheering and whooping the whole movie and screaming. I couldn't hear half what they were saying because it's usually a vacuum around them. And at the end, it's like, you got a problem, and you can find him. Call the A-team. It's like...
Well, let's talk about that, Kelly Wan, because that was a lot of what made it work for me, were the four actors, all of whom I thought were extremely likable. I mean, I was very familiar with three of them. I don't know Rampage Jackson from Action Jackson, but I really liked that guy. Mm-hmm. I thought they all had their own sort of shtick. They were distinct. They worked well together. They all seemed to like each other. And like in Charlie's Angels, they just all seemed to be having a lot of fun, and it was very infectious for me. But that didn't come across to you.
No, I didn't like the Mr. T surrogate. I would have rather had Terry Crews, like someone who's more Mr. T.
I don't even know who that is.
He's the President Camacho from Idiocracy.
Oh, you're right. Okay.
He's more T-esque to me than that guy. I don't know, this guy seemed too soft. And he didn't punch that many people. He didn't punch, and Jessica Biel's, like, she's never wearing anything revealing.
I thought she was pretty terrible, but I didn't care about her because it was a boys' club. I mean, it was almost
it's like Bradley Cooper's topless, but she's never topless. What's up with that? What kind of black guy's movie you call that? I don't want to
He's actually
that.
Hotter than she is.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yikes. Oh, my God. I was thinking I got to start doing some sit-ups.
And her
role is so thankless. I mean, she was fine for what she did. But
and she's in it a lot.
I
got the sense you're supposed to take her seriously. It's like in Striptease when the Demi Moore scenes come up and you're supposed to take the Demi Moore character seriously. And then and the Burt Reynolds Vaseline stuff happens. You go, oh, wait, now I get it. It's a comedy. And then Demi Moore comes back. Like, oh, yeah, it's true. Stripping is evil, yeah. It's like Jessica Biel was like, yeah, the army, they got to figure this out because these engraving plates could get into the wrong hands.
See, here's where I think that works, Kelly Wand, is I don't think she's that good, and she's attractive to a lot of people, and yeah, I mean, she's cute. But I think what her function is they have to offload all the exposition onto her and Patrick Wilson so that the four lead dudes can just have fun and goof around. And I think that's her dramatic. She's almost like the chorus. Like, what we're just going to watch, these guys are there for the enjoyable parts, but anytime something has to be explained or we need some setup for another scene, you roll out Jessica Biel. And so that, like Dingus is saying, I think her part was just thankless.
This will get guys to listen to exposition about ingredient plates.
Basically, yeah, yeah.
Jessica Biel. Yeah, I guess. There was one line I liked is when they're falling down in the tank and
they're trying to fly that tank.
Yeah, and she says it grouchily, like they're trying to fly it. Like they just launch like multiple jets, and she's just like, oh, hey, team. It's like her reading the script right there. Like, yeah.
I loved that line, though. That right
there. No. I did. I liked that, and I also liked, like, almost in that same scene where Mr. T wakes up. I keep calling him that. And then he's all, oh. And then Hannibal goes, well, technically we're not flying because they're, like, driving. That's funny. So I'll give it up for that. It almost had me during the tank scene. But it's like in X-Men 2 when Nightcrawler does that stuff where he like rescues what's-her-face, Rogue. He like teleports outside the jet. Remember that being like a really cool aerial action scene? And then in this one, it's not a good aerial action scene. In terms of aerial action scenes.
But it was, I mean, it was just so outrageous. It was like, it was almost like this setup again. I mean,
it was another thing, like, remember when we talked, it was Sherlock Holmes, like, the heights never matter. Like, heights not you. Like, you never feel like you're up high. That's how I felt in that action scene. I feel like they're not that high up. Because they're all whooping and enjoying themselves.
Right, right, exactly. And that's the thing, is there are no stakes. There are intentionally no stakes. No one is ever going to die in this movie. It's how the plan is going to come together. It's what they're going to do about a fact that they're on a tank and all the parachutes but one have been popped and they're plummeting to the earth. So they're going to use physics to steer it over a lake. And nobody's ever going to die. It's just how are they going to avoid dying in the least implausible way possible without completely veering into too much cartoon territory. I never thought they were going to die or that there was any danger.
Well, what's weird for me is thinking of those things, and I'm glad you brought up the vamping of Nightcrawler, is it? From X-Men 2, because for me, what I'm thinking of as they're falling in the tank is, for me, it's akin to a roller coaster ride, where I don't think people are. I don't think I'm going to die when I'm riding a roller coaster, but it's a lot of, you know, I'm having a great time. But if I fell off a building, I would have a slightly different feeling. And when they're falling in that tank, I just think it's a roller coaster ride. Whereas even though X-Men 2 is a comic book, I feel more intensely frightened for these characters because it's like they're falling off a building rather than riding a roller coaster. And I feel a little bit hypocritical talking about this because of the things I said about Iron Man 2 as far as stakes are concerned. But the fact that there's no stakes and the movie doesn't pretend that there are makes a big difference for me here.
Right. It's all about tone. I
it does pretend. You're supposed to be bummed when Gerald McCraney. Oh, it's him. Oh, he gets.
See, I disagree, Kelly Wand, because
they think so
they,
at all.
They blow him up and move on so quickly. He's a plot point.
No, it's a tragedy. Oh no, Gerald.
It's not.
McCraney.
And you know what? There's a joke that plays when he gets killed. Awesome.
What?
Looks just like Call of Duty, doesn't it? You know, he dies, and there's a joke at that moment. The movie doesn't care that they've killed the. I assume you're talking about the general. The movie doesn't care when he dies.
Wait, are you talking about the first time he supposedly dies or the second time, Kelly?
The second time.
Okay.
Yeah.
The second time we don't see his body blow up, but I guess that time it's real.
Except for the sequel.
Wow, you guys really like this movie. And you didn't watch the show, huh?
Dingus, did you know the show?
It was one of the few shows I could watch, and I liked it just fine. I thought it was completely stupid, but I liked a lot of the stuff in it. I liked, you know, all the welding and all the planning, because there's so much planning. We're going to execute this plan, and then we're going to pull it off, and something's going to go wrong, but eventually it's going to go right, and I had this in mind all along. And I like how this movie played off of it, like that sequence I mentioned earlier, the sequence where they go into Baghdad and they hijack the truck. And I love how that's cut, because in a lesser action film, we have you sort of briefly telling us what's going to happen, and then they just execute that, and then something goes wrong. Instead, they intercut that, and I really liked that. And the court-martial scene is another scene I really liked the way they cut, because they cut the court-martial scenes to show them getting court-martialed and show him going to the funeral and show other things within those things. So I thought the editing was well executed for this, and sometimes those things bother me. And when I was thinking about those other films I mentioned, I can't remember action scenes that really mattered to me at all or came together for me at all. And there's a few in this film that really worked for me because the tone of the film, Joe Carnahan got the tone of the film exactly right. And it hit my entire theater correctly, and it hit me. There are things that I think are stupid. I thought the CG in that ship being blown up was horrible, but I didn't care because I really liked what was going on with the characters at that point.
Well, in the A-Team show, though, they were the innocent victims, and then they'd help the other people in trouble. Like Mexican villages, you know, like the Three Amigos. But in this, I mean, I don't know. It seemed like they were kind of complicit in their issue. Like, weren't they doing something kind of dicey? I don't know. They just seemed like
the very beginning.
Yeah.
Well, what was interesting to me about the very beginning, and I thought about this sort of semi-guiltily halfway through the film, is that I really railed against Robin Hood for being the kind of origin story that it was. And about 45 minutes into this movie, I realized that, and actually when we were talking about Robin Hood, I mentioned A-Team and said, well, I just want antics. I don't need an origin story. I don't want to see what happened that got the A-Team to be the A-Team. I just want super antics. And then about 45 minutes into this film, I realized, oh, this is an origin story. And I realized for some reason it didn't bother me the way it bothered me with Robin Hood, because we were getting to see so much of what they became, and the time passing, like 8 years and 80 successful missions later, that sort of like time gap where you get a sense that, oh, these guys have become a band of brothers in this time. None of that bothered me, and I just thought that it was much more cohesive and really worked.
Okay.
Have we swayed you?
No, I don't understand this. Except for the tank part, I'm surprised any of those action sequences worked for you. Like, the tank one at least has something we haven't seen before in a movie.
When have you seen a rocket launcher shoot through a ship that then spills out its cargo containers like a bunch of like Legos on top of the heroes? Because I thought that was pretty unprecedented as well.
Nah, they look fake. And also, The Losers, wasn't that set at Port of Los Angeles?
Port of Los Angeles, I think they must have some sort of a deal where they want people to come shoot there.
And all the containers were empty, so they didn't, I don't know. If they'd been full of cocaine or something, I would have liked it. More Shane Black.
Well, see, I felt that was something I'd never seen before. I'm like, oh, God, we're at the Port of Los Angeles. This is terrible. Oh, they're just doing that so they can do their little, you know, three-cup Monty thing. But then, you know.
Oh, yeah, see, they stole the three-card Monty thing from Robin Hood.
But then the dude blows up the tanker, and it falls over, and it's, you know, that's their big climactic set piece. And I was like, oh, wow, good. I'm glad I got to see that. And, you know, and even though it was sort of like the Brontosaurus run in King Kong, you know, when somebody's like, I guess it was Mr. T or whoever, is like running around at the base of the ship, and the different cargo containers are falling all around him, you know, I was like, good. We've never seen this at the Port of L.A. before. This is something new and different, and I like this.
That's when we saw it, was the Brontosaurus run in King Kong.
That's true.
It was, except in that, at least, people did get stepped on, and in this, no one dies from all those containers.
Well, I just think about this, Kelly. I wondered if you would object to this, like if you would feel this should have been rated R.
You think
I think this movie absolutely worked because it was so playful. Not being rated R. I didn't mind that whether or not we saw people getting shot or killed, or I was totally okay with the light, frivolous tone of this. I think this movie would not have worked as well if it were rated R.
You're high.
Well, I don't believe that every movie should be rated R, though. So you have a philosophical difference there.
Dumbo should be rated R.
Well, every action movie. I mean, I don't mind that sometimes when dudes are shooting guns at each other, it's playful.
No, because in PG-13 you never get blood, which to me is such a stupid rule.
You get a little. You got a little.
You get carefully rationed blood clots.
Right.
That's dumb. That's a terrible way to run a railroad. Or
it's a PG. It's a, you know what? This blood implies injury. It implies a grievous wound.
So at 17, you're allowed to see that. 13, you're not allowed to see.
It's not a matter of 17 or 13. I don't want to get into a rating system. It's a matter of the tone of the film. In those old westerns, when somebody gets shot and he clutches his stomach and he falls over and dies, you don't necessarily need to show a bloody, grievous wound to make that effective. That can still work if it fits in with the tone of the movie, I think.
And
a PG-13 movie like this, I don't think, we're seeing people get shooting at each other, but I don't think you need to see anybody getting shot, and you don't need to point out that, you know, somebody is bleeding is going to have to go to the emergency room. None of that matters, I think. I think
so you agree with Mr. T. You feel Mr. T is totally right.
You mean B.A. Baracus's nonviolent stance? See, he comes through that. That's his little character arc, which, again, it was really quaint, and I was totally okay with that. You know, a very quaint, convenient struggle of conscience. Let's just drop that in the movie, and that's his little character bit. You know, that's what he struggles with. That characterizes him. I was fine with that. That worked just fine for me.
He only read one quote by Gandhi, but Hannibal knows two quotes from Gandhi, and that changes his total position on.
Well, that, and you know, it's his brothers. He has to save his brothers there, and yeah, I like that. That totally worked for me. And you know, when it's like knowing the Arab was the general. When he takes the hat off to reveal his mohawk, that's not a reveal. That's a payoff. I mean, you know at that point that he has shaved his mohawk, and he's just showing you. Just like you know they're going to successfully live through this the tank falling, or that all the plans are going to come through one way or the other. You know, these aren't necessarily surprises. It's just how are they going to do it? You know, when is he going to change his mind and shave his mohawk back?
When the plot calls for it at the very end.
Yeah, exactly. That's the culmination of his little character arc. Absolutely.
No, they should have all gotten mohawks. That would have been bolder.
I like that you see him at the beginning with his mohawk, and he has a fight scene, sort of in third. You get this third person fight scene, and then it shows up at the end. I liked that, and you know the rating didn't bother me at all either.
And he said "fool" too much. That was cheap sauce, dude.
They had to really straddle the line, and I'd like to be able to talk about this, in how they paid sort of homage to these characters without caricaturing them or without just doing impressions. So he had the toughest job, I think. Rampage did. Plus, his name is Rampage. And casting somebody who comes from a fighting background is a good idea, you know, given the things that Mr. T has done and the movies that Mr. T has done. So asking this guy to do it instead of a serious actor or something is no more ridiculous than asking a serious actor to do the original B.A. Baracus instead of letting Mr. T do it. And so he had a really tough job, because that is a weird, iconic, over-the-top presentation, and I thought he walked the line very admirably. You know, he had the pity and fool tattoos on his hands, and he did enough fool that he gave us an idea of the old character without parodying it, and he made it his own. I thought it was really tough to do that. I thought the person who was least successful was Liam Neeson, who I liked them. Who is probably my favorite actor of all those guys? Although I want to talk about Charlton Copley too, because I love that guy. But
he was the best of four, I thought.
He was the most unfettered, I would say.
And he was most like the essence of the original character, and none of the Bradley Cooper kind of was too. But he was Bradley Cooper was too self-assured, and like that was Hannibal's thing. I don't know. It's like they're too similar.
Yeah, you're right about that, actually, and the fact that the movie even makes a nod to that at the very end, where he steals Hannibal's line, which I thought was a little weird. But I was most interested because I don't remember how Dwight Schultz did Murdoch so much. I remember the character, but I don't remember how it's different from the way Charlton Copley does it. And I really liked the things he was doing. I thought it was interesting that they were messing around with his accent and letting him play around like that. It seemed like at the beginning he was very random and amusing, But I thought he did a great job sort of bringing that character out. I never had an idea, and this is pushing the character too much, to ask, is he really crazy or is he just playing it crazy? And I don't know if the show ever resolves that or if it's just a TV show and we don't care.
He's actually crazy in the TV show?
No.
Well, that's my question. What do you think, Kelly?
I think he's just crazy in the sense that Mr. T keeps calling him crazy in the sense that they're all fools, too.
So he's just wacky. Like, they don't actually imply that he has a history of mental illness in the TV.
He's network TV crazy.
Okay.
Well, no, they definitely...
It's just kind of like being dead on Lost. Lost dead.
They okay, definitely what? Imply he has a history of mental illness. He's in and out of mental institutions.
Yeah, I know, but but what he does on the show is never, like, screwy squirrel Warner Brothers character. Who like chainsaw people.
Well, he's not that kind of crazy, but that's not the only thing that's crazy. I mean, you don't have to be violent to be crazy.
No. But I thought Charlton Copley improved on that. Like, he made him genuinely crazy, or crazier. Or craziness part of his flight plan strategy. Like, you have to be crazy to fly the A-team. Only a crazy pilot would take on that stuff.
He had one of the most interesting and head-scratching lines for me near the end of the film, where he's talking to Face and he says, "I have the most to lose of any of you, or of any of them."
Well, that's because they're putting him in the armored head to get shot in the head.
So his crazy head's more valuable than their sane head?
No. They're going to put him in front of a bullet. I mean, they're going to make him be the decoy body.
That's all that line means.
That's all that line means, is that he knows he's about to get shot in the head and hope that... Because I didn't understand that either, Dingus, and that's again, something you find out when you discover what the plan is that he's got to sit there and take... Because I thought it was just going to be a dummy or something. That he's got to sit there and take the bullet to the head to make Patrick Wilson think that he's killed the general.
Oh, that's right, because he's got the liquid Kevlar thing on his head.
Right.
Oh, well, that makes sense, but Charlton Copley embodies that line with such meaning.
Yeah, yeah.
But it seems like, do you have a whole family on this ship?
Right, there's going to be backstory coming up out of this, right?
That's great. Oh, well, duh. Oh, that's great.
Wouldn't he hurt the bullet paying off the cast iron thing, though?
Doesn't matter. Those are real-world rules, Kelly Wand.
Isn't there blood on it, though? Blood on the gauze after? Is that fake? Is that from a blood squib they put on the thing?
They definitely show where they're rolling out blood for...
So you can see PG-13 fake blood, and that's proof that it didn't really happen because PG-13, so it's a spoiler because the rating's a spoiler then.
But you also already knew that the general was already dead, so.
But why does the rating bother you, Kelly? Did the rating bother you in the television show?
I was too dumb to know better then.
Because what I remember from the TV show is...
Plus on the show, they would actually shoot a ton of people. While I was on this, they didn't.
They shot people, didn't they? Yeah, all those Blackwater guys.
Black Forest.
Oh, Black Forest.
See what they did there? James Cameron.
What I remember from the show is a lot of explosions and people flying, like bodies flying through the air, and then they would get up and run away. And then guys getting shot in the leg or the arm or the shoulder. I don't remember people dying. And so, like, when he shoots B.A., when he's carjacking him, I think B.A.'s line is, "What is this, opposite day?" He wings him with the bullet, and then he gets sewed up a little while later. And I realized that this is another point of hypocrisy for me, because I complained about this with The Losers. But, again, The Losers didn't understand its tone, and this film totally understands its tone.
Yeah, and that's not hypocrisy, Dingus. I mean, it really is a matter of it's internal consistency. It's what does the movie want you to believe? What kind of stakes does it want to put up, if any at all? You know, The Losers starts off killing a helicopter full of 20 kids so that we know it's a dangerous, terrible world. And there's nothing like that here. You know, this is, like you said, a roller coaster ride. I don't think it's hypocrisy at all.
So Carnahan made Narc, and that had Jason Patrick in it, and then The Losers had Jason Patrick in it, but he's not in this. But Carnahan's in it.
No, but Patrick Wilson is in this. So.
And he's not, by the way, this is weird. He's not listed at all on the IMDb page, and this movie is not listed on his IMDb page, and I'm wondering what
Patrick Wilson?
Yeah.
Did he? Wow, okay.
Well, I'm wondering if this is all a part of the My Name is Lynch thing, because John Hamm isn't listed either.
John Hamm does, like, because John Hamm also had that uncredited appearance in A Single Man, which is what I thought of when he shows up at the end.
Well, also one of the army officials, it said Carnahan on his.
I saw that. Yeah, I saw that.
That's subtle.
Hey, I do want to ask about one particular scene that really freaked me out a little bit.
Can I? Is it the gun or the phone? Was it that scene?
Exactly. Yes.
That was so weird.
I didn't understand. Part of it I really liked, and part of it felt so clumsy that it felt like the studio said, "We need a rewrite." And they threw this in.
Did you really think it was clumsy? Because I thought it was an odd... I mean, it was our villain. It was two of our villains. And it's sort of like when the villains interact, it's a whole different level, kind of. I mean, it was a little disturbing, but I quite liked that scene.
Oh, I liked it a lot, too. But I have a love-hate relationship with it because I liked what was going on with the clumsiness within the scene. You know, gun or phone, that's a suppressor, not a silencer. That's how you
counterclockwise, yeah.
Right. But the way it was cut together felt so weird. It just felt like a weird scene to me.
Yeah.
And I really wanted you guys to talk about it. You know, by the way, the guy who plays Pike is one of the film's writers. So I don't know where that sort of works into all of this. But you know, he's in the middle of that scene, so it's not... It's not an accidental scene. It just felt weird to me.
They had sort of established that Patrick Wilson's character, you know, Lynch, was a sort of frat boy and not really practiced at the art of killing and all of that stuff. So,
hold on, let me get that.
Okay, hold on, I got to get the phone just a second. It's Patrick Wilson.
God.
But he's competent in. Well, so pseudo competent in fighting at the end, but it's his.
But no, he's not. Because that's the thing is they know exactly what he's going to do, and they're one step ahead of him. Kind of like they're leading him by the nose.
Right, right, right.
I think. Like, I don't think he is competent in combat.
No, but when he's punching, at least he can land a punch. You know, he has that line where don't let the scarf. Confuse you or whatever he says. So he has a mini fight with Hannibal where it looks like he can punch a guy and shoot a
right.
guy.
Well, it's like he knows, and Hannibal is letting him. Like Hannibal is matching the fighting style that will let him get hit because he has to make Lynch believe that he's beat him in a fight.
Right.
And then once Lynch shoots Charlton Copley in the head, then Hannibal comes back and is easily able to dispatch him. So I think the idea is that he's just a frat boy. I mean, he's not practiced at either shooting or fighting, and they know how to play him perfectly. At least that was the sense I got. So I didn't mind the fact that he's got men around him who don't know how to screw a silencer onto a pistol. You know what, though, Dingus? I infinitely prefer everything they were doing there. I mean, consider what you get in The Losers with Jason Patrick, where it's just so excruciatingly terrible. I mean, it was so nice to see villain banter that worked, like when they're talking about the woman that comes in. Why did we hire her again? You know, that was okay. It was just annoying frat boy stuff.
Predictable.
But it totally worked, though. I thought that stuff totally worked.
Needed an extra twist. That part too easy.
And Patrick Wilson is great. He even his throwaways were great.
Yeah,
there's that moment where he says broadsword.
Yeah,
I like that.
Did you come up with that? That's awesome. Broadsword. What did you think?
I still don't believe either one of you. I think you didn't like it. Go on.
I like it. One of the things that I guess maybe about an hour in, that the pacing of it is just relentless. I mean, there's, and even the music sort of is along with this, and I did sort of think about this BMW short that I mentioned earlier and just sort of thought, well, you can do that kind of pacing with a short, but you can't do that kind of pacing with a movie. But in the end, I think that works, and I think that it evens out. But there are a few moments during this where it just feels like it won't let up, but eventually I think it works to the movie's benefit.
Well, you can look at, I think, have you seen Smoke and Aces, Dingus?
I have, and I don't think I like it as much as you do.
Well, I don't like Smoking Aces that much at all. I think Smoking Aces is kind of a mess, but But one of the problems with Smoke and Aces is it's trying to do that kind of pace, but it's got far too many characters. I mean, it takes someone like Guy Ritchie to really sustain that pace with that many characters. And Joe Carnahan is not that. I just think
he thinks he's Guy Ritchie, though. He's poor man's Guy Ritchie.
Well, with movies like Narc and like this, where he's much more focused on a few characters, I think that works. I think
this wasn't a few characters though. This was
was four guys goofing around. Everyone else
and Beale and the army and
they were ancillary, right?
Wearing suits.
But the thing is, Kelly Wan, none of those characters was as important as say all the different characters in Smoke and Aces. Smoke and Aces had maybe a dozen different characters, all of whom were supposed to be equally important. It was like an ensemble piece. This wasn't really an ensemble piece. It was a four-dude piece. And there were a few ancillary characters given largely thankless tasks. But I think this pace works better when you're not trying to keep track of 12 characters.
I think this pace works better when you have four people who are more distinctive from each other. Then they're all just screaming, yeah, as they fall down in a tank.
Can't believe you think they're not distinctive from each
other.
They're
all just,
that's part of what worked for me. They were all, you know, broad, easy strokes.
Charlton Copley's cackling because he's crazy. Bradley Cooper's cackling because he's cocky and good-looking. Hannibal's cackling because the plan's coming together. And Mr. T's, like, screaming, which sounds like cackling.
Exactly. Races. What more do you want? What more do you want? All of that, that's exactly the perfect encapsulation of what that was and why it worked, I thought.
You get to see more of What's-Her-Face, Zoe Saldana, than of Beale. That's what I'm really upset about.
Hannibal is never cackling. What are you talking about? He's never cackling.
That's true. He has a very
nice try, though.
He has a hearty guffaw.
Nah. His accent goes in and out, just like What's-His-Face's Jake Gyllenhaal.
Kelly Wan, I have one thing to ask you. Did you take my Steely Dan CD?
Horrible.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between, counting 1, 2, 3.
How about a 3x3? We'll put you out of your misery here.
Did I lose that argument?
You guys listened you guys listened to that Steely Dan CD like 7 times.
Were we doing something else when we were listening to it, Kelly?
Maybe the losers isn't a good example. Guns of Navarone.
Dingus, why don't you explain for us this week's 3x3, since it was your pick. What do you got for us?
This is your three favorite TV movies. Am I right or am I wrong?
Is V the Final Battle a TV movie or a miniseries?
Ah, good point.
Exactly. All right, these are your what you think, and I apologize for this. This is broad, or what? I don't know how Tom
Broad Pike.
He said sloppy and sloppy or something. But it's your what you think are your three most effective adaptations.
If it annoyed Tom, it's good, though. So.
That's the good housekeeping seal of approval.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Will I go first? Dingus, do you need to elaborate any more on that?
Effective. Define effective. How do you mean effective? What is an adaptation?
Yeah, what are we supposed to do with this?
All right. Well, I could have made it just about adaptations of novels, which was what I was going to do. This is dovetailing off of Kelly Wan's three video games that should be movies instead of other video games that are not movies or something. And I decided to, because that gave me a little bit of trouble, to just go on to adaptations. And I was going to make it just novels, but I decided to open it up and say it could be, it doesn't have to be just novels, but, and it doesn't have to be a faithful adaptation per se. It doesn't have to, in deference specifically to Tom.
Right, because he hasn't read that many books.
So it has to be what you think is an effective adaptation and your three most effective adaptations. There you go.
I know the novel The Car was good.
Dingus,
it
do you
was,
think,
but what evil reads The Car?
Do you think, Dingus, that Kelly Wan chose A-Team because it's an adaptation of a TV show, so it would technically qualify? I don't know. I don't know if it'll make Kelly Wan's list.
I think he's going to choose something that was a script, and he'll say that it was adapted from the script to the movie.
That's actually, I thought about doing that myself.
A sequel is an adaptation to an earlier movie in the series. It's adapting to part one.
It's more like an annexation or an appendage.
It's a spinoff. So Alien vs. Predator Requiem is an adaptation of Oh, never mind.
All right, well, I start because I have, by the way, my topic this week, Kelly Wand, you're going to love this. This one's for you, buddy. So since I give next week's 3x3, I will start us off. I hate this list. So my third most effective adaptation is Constantine, because it made comic book nerds angry.
You know what?
Because they weren't just happy. Hold on, I want to hear what you have to say about this, Kelly Wand, but let me explain. They were angry because he wasn't blonde and English. Not because, you know, they didn't notice that they were given a good movie. They were just mad because, hey, Constantine's supposed to be British and he's supposed to be blonde. That's my impression, by the way, of comic book dudes. So I love that. I love that about Constantine, that it's a great movie. I love that movie. And people are mad that he's not blonde and British. Okay, so Kelly Wand, what do you got to say to that? Because you're a comic book nerd.
Yeah, but I like Constantine the movie, and I didn't read the comic, even though I like Garth Ennis, who wrote it. But I thought it's not that. I don't know. My point is, you didn't read the comic, so right. You can't put it on your list. You have to be an adaptation that you can speak of with first-hand knowledge.
You know, I thought about doing that. I thought about...
You have to redo number three.
Well, that's the thing, is I thought about only doing things where I was familiar with the source material.
Dingus said that was one of the prerequisites.
I don't think he did. His is he gave us sloppy choice. He gave us a broad, sloppy topic on purpose. So I chose one where I don't know the first thing about the source material. But really, for me, that's all it needs to be an effective adaptation, is for me to enjoy the movie. Whether or not it's faithful to the source material, I honestly could not care less about. As a matter of fact, all three of mine betray their source material in some way or another. And to me, that's...
Yeah, mine too.
That can be an important part of an adaptation. An adaptation, a non-effective adaptation, is often a slavish one.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree with that. Yeah. You didn't think I'd agree with you, did you?
Didn't. Right.
Your cat.
I didn't think the cat would agree, yeah.
Your cat. Tell your cat to stop calling me during the podcast, by the way. It's really obnoxious.
All right, so that's my number three.
I like it, except we've already heard your Constantine spiel before. So
no, I know. I'm not going to. I'll just list it.
Thumbing Dingus's list. Yeah, I'm just going to say Constantine again. You suck it. I don't care what his topic is. Constantine. Best through Keanu Reeves movies, Constantine.
Well, wait till you see where I go with number two and number one. All right, Kelly, what's your number three? What do you got for us?
My number three, none of mine are funny, so you can just skip mine, which because they're not going to be thoughtful in either. Like, funny is my so they're neither, basically. And this is the one I have the least notes on, because I haven't seen this in forever, but I remember how it affected me. A little film called The Trial. Orson Welles' adaptation of The Trial. Did you ever see that?
Is that about Nuremberg?
Anthony Perkins. All right, forget it.
Is that a
It was
Kafka?
A minor Kafka, yeah.
It's
very
Kafka,
good.
Kafka, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's Kafka.
Oh, you say Kafka? How quaint.
That's right. I also say Van Gogh.
And the reveal is that he didn't cry at his mother's funeral. Spoiler.
That's Camus.
What?
Camus. That's The Stranger.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, good Lord.
You're an idiot.
Existential literature is it's not my strong point.
Unless it's A-teamer.
Well, what's he on trial for?
Then you're you never know. You never find out. But also the sets. It's like this really tiny, small, well, it's not small, but it's basically, it's a non sequitur novel, so it seems almost, I like things that are hard to adapt. That's the theme of my list.
Ah.
Unfilmable adaptations that succeeded.
Who directed The Trial?
Orson Welles.
Is he in it too, or he just directed an Anthony?
He does like the narration at the beginning of this really depressing, weird little like fable that opens it, a la A Serious Man, mm-hmm. about a guy who's like waiting. He's like, he has to wait his whole life to go for to get to the trial.
And did you say Hopkins or Perkins?
Perkins, Psycho. And it's just a series of conversations in like really weird sets. It's like Eraserhead meets The Third Man, another movie you probably
sounds awesome. No, I love The Third Man. Especially
and it's Downey. Yeah, I do too. That Zither, is that what it is?
I was being actually facetious. I hate that Zither. But I do like The Third Man.
You don't like the Zither?
I really don't. I really do not. Right. I know it's supposed to be like...
It's the only Zither movie. It's like hating... You don't like Zamfir?
Oh my God, what movie did Zamfir do the... the music for.
The Second
DC
Man.
Cab? Yeah.
Wait, what were you...
It's an adaptation of The First Man called The Third.
Dingus, have you seen The Trial?
No, I haven't, but that's pretty exciting.
Okay, I want to
see it. Black and white.
Oh, well, never mind then. Good Lord.
There's no subtitles, though.
Gunga Din is in it.
It's just a creepy-ass movie, and it's awesome, and it's just like the novel. And Orson Welles, it was like his last great movie, I think. And he didn't get to do too many movies. Like, his Magnificent Ambersons is only, like, half-finished. Never mind, I'm talking to idiots.
And can you even find a decent version of the Magnificent Ambersons?
I don't know.
I don't know if you can either.
VHS, that's the only format I watch things on. So.
But I mean, like a proper cut of it, because I've heard how great a movie it's supposed to be, and I don't know that a proper cut of it exists. It has to. I'm an idiot, as you just said.
But it's only based on. I meant more Tom. I could never call you an idiot.
Isn't the Magnificent Ambersons like a musical?
It sounds like... I spent years thinking the Brothers Karamazov was about trapeze artists. Just because of the way that was worked for it. Like, oh, the Brothers Karamazov!
So wait, seriously, though. The Magnificent Ambersons is not...
Like it's about a guys and dolls. Weird family, and they are weak.
Stop it.
They're Southern.
Is that black and white? I know nothing about Magnificent Ambersons. I really did assume it was some kind of...
It's got Joseph Cotten in it, your favorite zither object.
Wow. Okay.
Zitherist.
Yeah. Some people like it more than Citizen Kane, which you...
And that's Orson Welles, Magnificent Ambersons?
Yeah.
Is it a Western?
Citizen Kane. There's like a YouTube thing where he's talking to H.G. Wells on the radio, like while he's making Citizen Kane. And they're just like, he's one of them super English and Orson Welles is super American. It's like that, what's that show I hit you to? Snuffbox.
Snuffbox.
It's like that, except people good. With the last name of Wells. Spoiler alert.
All right, these are great, Kelly Wand. I count on you to fill the gaps in my cultural knowledge, so thank you.
It's hard to talk about The Trial. It's like a modernist... nothing happens in it. It's
you've sold it.
It's like Lost, if Lost was good.
Oh, well, now I don't want to see it. Great.
If Lost was good, which makes it an unlost.
So it's nothing like Lost, in other words.
It's a found, then.
It all takes place in purgatory, but it's a black and white purgatory.
All right, no, I want to see it. I mean, I thought I knew the it's a short story, right? It's Kafka's just a bunch of short stories. I thought I knew.
No,
it's not the one where... So Camus is the one where you find out at the end the guy didn't cry at his mother's funeral. That's Camus.
That's The Stranger.
Good Lord. All right.
What's wrong with you?
Who did that movie?
The Cure.
Dingus, what's your number three? Get us out of this.
I don't know if I can. First of all, I want to address that, no, The Magnificent Ambersons is not a Western, which I think you asked.
All right, it sounds like a Western or a musical is all I have to say. What's that thing about the like a bunch of brothers, like Seven Brides for Seven Brothers? Magnificent Ambersons is not an adaptation of that musical.
The Trial is a novel, by the way, so just saying. All right. 1925. But anyway, yeah. But you're thinking of The Metamorphosis, which is a play, which is kind of like a short story.
Metamorphosis isn't a play. Rhinoceros is a play. You're thinking of Rhinoceros, Kelly Wand.
That's Ionesco, right?
Yeah.
No, that's The Maids you're thinking of now.
Did you know Christopher Durang wrote The Secret of My Success with Michael J. Fox? Like, he was one of the writers on that.
Now you're just making stuff up.
All right, Dingus's turn.
So, Dingus, your number three is The Magnificent Ambersons.
Right. Can we move on now?
If anyone says Lord of the Rings, you suck. Okay, go. Booyah! Badonkadonk! I'm ready to pounce on Lord of the Rings, bastards.
I want Kelly Wand to say more things that if we mention them, they will suck. Go ahead, Kelly Wand.
Star Wars.
Okay.
Adaptation of THX 1138.
All right, go ahead. What else?
Ghost Rider.
Don't encourage him, Dingus. He's gonna trump one of our... He's gonna scoop something one of us has on our list. So
good.
Better get started.
All right, Kelly Wand. I love what you did with this list. I love that you went for something that you know and that you think is a good adaptation. That's very good. Because I also basically confined it to things that are adaptations of works that I know very, very well. And that I thought were effective, even if they weren't slavish.
I would think that you can only judge its effectiveness if you're familiar with the source material. Don't you think, Dingus? Doesn't that make sense?
I would think that, but you might game it in another way, and if it just upsets
you. If games is your industry, if you're a games reviewer, maybe you would.
Why does the source material have anything to do with an adaptation? It doesn't.
Because you're judging both. You're judging its...
No, you're not. No, you're not.
You're judging its deviations. You're judging Constantine's deviations.
Why? What does that have to do with anything?
Well, you're just more of an authority.
but I'm not talking about Constantine as an adaptation. I'm talking about it as a movie.
No, the list was for adaptations, not movies.
But an effective adaptation does not have to have anything to do with the source material.
You don't know that it has nothing to do
with
it.
Well, wait till you get to my number one.
All right.
And my number two. Well, I'm going to wait for my turn. Lord of the Rings, totally. But guess which of the three books? All right, Dingus, go. What's your number?
Sorry, Dingus. Hate myself.
Two Towers.
Oh, can't wait. I can't wait until Two Towers comes out. So excited.
Me too.
Mm-hmm.
All right. My number three, which we still haven't gotten to yet. I'm going to give you guys a quote, and we're going to stop this silliness right now. You ready for my quote?
Mm-hmm. Rock and roll.
I know you didn't... Well, here we go. I'm going to try it again. I know you didn't mean it when you killed her, and now you'll make it right.
Tideland?
The Matrix.
No and no.
What happened to Bibi Jane?
Midnight Run.
Night of the Hunter. Midnight of the Hunter.
Magnificent Ambersons.
Midnight Cowboy Andersons. Urban Cowboy.
It's a terrible word association game.
Give us another quote. That one's too hard.
Happiness.
That could be from Ghostbusters.
This was a film from 1990 directed by Rob Reiner.
Princess Bride.
Yeah. Princess Bride. Right?
Is it Princess Bride? Good Lord.
It's got to be Princess Bride.
It was written by William Goldman.
Princess Bride.
Yeah.
From a novel by Stephen King.
Misery.
Misery.
Finally, we get to Misery. Thank you very much for guessing all of those other films.
I like it. I like your number three.
All right, with
why didn't you do a line about like Dirty Bird or something that we could actually?
Yeah,
because like you would have guessed it. I could have said you're a cockadoodie, but I didn't, did I?
But why would the listeners want to hear us go? For 5 minutes. Why don't you just give us some easy, and then they get it, and everyone's happy? Why do you give us some really obscure?
Why would they want to hear any of this?
My pig always. That's true. They don't, is the simple answer. My pig always faces south. Isn't that a quote from that movie? Or something like that?
All right, some people might argue that that the adaptations of Stand By Me or Shawshank are better adaptations. But I did, in deference to Tom, who I think has a reasonably good point about... Well, I don't know if he does. I think knowing the source material for this is valuable, whether or not Tom's point is valid. But I don't know either The Body or Rita Hayworth in The Shawshank Redemption nearly as well as I know the novel Misery. At least knew the novel Misery when I went to see Misery in a theater. And that was really what I was thinking about when I was doing this category, was how I felt first watching the film, knowing the source material while I was sitting in the film and how it affected me. And if it's a good enough film, whether or not it adheres to the source material, makes a big difference to you, especially if you really loved the source material. I had read a lot of Stephen King, or was still reading a lot of Stephen King, and I think this is one of the best adaptations of his work. First of all, I think the casting is great. I don't think you can get better casting than Kathy Bates for Annie Wilkes. I to this day, the James Caan casting befuddles and confuses me, but I think it works out. And just reading, and I went back and read parts of the books that I chose as my adaptations, and it was interesting to see the things that changed and the things that stayed the same. And I think this adaptation is a fantastic especially for how they get this character, Annie Wilkes, how they get her shifts down, because it's very difficult. Stephen King tends to write a lot of cerebral stuff, and or at least a lot of internal monologues. And it's really tough to film internal monologues without doing a lot of narration. And the combination of Kathy Bates' performance with the direction, the editing, and the music really gets her shifts quickly and sort of conveys the menacing nature of this character to make it really an effective adaptation.
What are some of the differences? Like, what were some? Because I know the
movie, I know a I big one.
Yeah, well, like, what were some of the big differences, and why do you feel they worked?
I even have an anecdote about the biggest one.
Okay.
No, I want to hear what Kelly Wand had to say. Go ahead.
Well, I read a book by William Goldman who wrote the script adapting Misery, and there was a certain point, and the reason he wanted to do it was because when he read the book, the scene where this is a huge spoiler, I feel bad if you haven't read the book because it's a great book, the scene where she cuts his foot off was the main reason he wanted to write the script of it, because he thought it was just such an insane scene, such a freak out, that he wanted to be part of it. And then when he wrote it, they said, no, you got to change it. She can't just cut his foot off because it's just too – the audience will never identify with her at all, like, after that scene. Like, it's just too – there won't be a pathetic quality to her. She'll just be, like, pure evil. And he fought them tooth and nail and, like, whined and bitched and moaned and, like, threatened to leave the project and then eventually did what they wanted. And then when he finally saw the finished movie, he was like, they were right. It's way better that she doesn't cut it off. And he was like – he changed his mind based on the finished.
Is it because that's too permanent? Because I think at the end of Audition and how brutal that is, and I don't see much of a qualitative difference between, well, I guess one's a lot more sadistic, but what difference does it make if she cuts his foot off or hobbles him? Is it the idea that he's going to recover from being hobbled? Isn't that permanent?
Maybe it's just a visual thing. Like, you're permanently maiming. You're it's gone forever. Like, he can't even have, like, a fake foot put on, can he? And she also cuts off his thumb in the book, if I remember right.
Oh, wow.
Screen, with an electric knife. Do you remember that, Dingus?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Whether we like it or not, the idea of cutting off a part of a man's body, no matter what part it is emasculating. And there's no way we can't think of it that way as filmgoers. Right. If a guy gets his foot cut off by a woman, he might as well have gotten his penis cut off. Yeah. And
well, why does that work in the book, though? I mean, what makes that different?
Maybe because it's not James Caan in the book, or maybe just the idea. The way it's written in the book works just because you hear what he's thinking, because she says something about anesthetic, and he, like, she's already drugged, and he's like, wait, anesthetic? What'd she say? What was that? It's this really awesome setup to it. Then maybe that's...
The book also has this tendency, and Stephen King does this in a lot of his writing, of doing obvious foreshadowing. So that you say, well, this was well before his thumb got cut off. And then as a reader, you're like, what? And then it leads up to that, but you have this nagging remembrance of, oh, this is before his thumb got cut off, or whatever. I mean, he does that time and time again. And... Yeah. But also, reading through what the character is going through mentally is a much different experience than watching somebody get their cut foot off and then watching them getting cauterized by a blowtorch.
you like that, Tom?
Those things are just completely different. And so adapting it to getting him hobbled in both feet, this idea of, oh, this is our protagonist, and we know he can recover from this and overcome this. These are different things.
Also, in the book, if I remember right, at a certain point, the whole town suspects her of something, and they're like camped outside the house or something. And in the movie, that's kind of changed and made a little more realistic.
Right.
I vaguely remember thinking that when I read the book, like, why? They actually know, but somehow they're not going in. There's just, like, this lynch mob outside her house, and
Well, the main thing for me is that so much of Stephen King's books, at least in those early books that I remember reading, take place inside the character's head. So that the beginning of Misery is him basically existing in a coma and coming out of that coma and remembering and dealing with the pain, and Stephen King writing about the pain coming and going like a tide or like waves over pilings.
Yeah.
And him and what his mind is doing is substituting his pilings for his legs. You know, thinking of his shattered legs as being pilings that a tide might come over, and that's pain, the tide being pain. And that's the whole beginning of this book. And mm-hmm. and so much of what Stephen King writes is this sort of mental space. And a lot of movies can't get that. And Misery gets that. Misery gets how to convey his mental space without narration.
Another interesting deviation, I wondered which of these you thought worked better. In the book, he pretends to burn the finished copy of the Misery sequel that he spent the whole book writing for her. But in the movie, he actually does burn it to, like, taunt her in her final moments. But in the book, he keeps a secret copy of it, and it actually gets published later. He's like, I'd be crazy to lose that. Like King couldn't bear the idea of an author actually, like, burning his own work, something he'd worked on for, like, a year. So he profits from the experience. Anyway.
Wait,
that's a
which
big difference,
one?
Too. In the movie, he actually does burn the Misery.
Right.
He wrote for. In the book, he pretends to. He burns, like, a bunch of blank pages, and then you find out later that he published it.
Right, and I think that the movie's choice is much more effective. That's the idea that he could have put that much work in and done it in sort of good faith, because he knows he has to fool her, and because he gets into the work. And I think that's an effective moment, especially if you write the idea that you have one copy of something and then burn it after doing that much work and producing it and knowing there's no way I can reproduce this. There's no way. If I wrote a novel and had to destroy the only existing copy of that novel, which is more effective given what she has made him do earlier in the book.
There's also that really good part where he writes a thing where she comes back to, the Misery comes back to life, and she goes, that's weak. You can't have that. That's such a cop out. And he eventually goes, he's right. It sucks.
Right. She's not going to let him have any shortcuts.
Right. It has to be like a good. Yeah, it has to make sense. See, if Darlton had had that with Lost, if they'd had any woke soap with them, imagine how awesome the Lost finale would have been. The end.
All right, good. Misery. Are all of your Stephen King novels, Dingus?
Thanks for ruining my list. I can't believe Stephen King wrote The Return of the King, but he did.
When King got hit by that truck, Kathy Bates sent him a little note that said, got Novril. Remember Novril?
Ouch.
Yeah.
What is Novril?
It's like the pain med in Misery.
Ah,
yeah,
keep sedated.
Nice. It's a made-up pain med that he has.
Yeah.
Wow.
Tom, you don't know what Novril is? Oh, dude, softcore. Softcore film criticism.
I don't think I've read... I'm sure I've read Stephen King short stories, but I don't know... you know what? I read The Stand a long time ago. But yeah, so this is all news to me. This and The Trial. All right.
You didn't read Misery, Tom? I'm surprised.
Good Lord, no. Why would I read that?
Because it's awesome.
I don't read books. I watch TV.
You didn't read The Long Walk. You didn't read The Running Man. You didn't read Salem's Lot. You didn't read The Shining.
I saw the movie.
Oh,
I saw the TV show.
You're a horror nut, and you didn't read like early good King. Like,
I was busy reading H.P. Lovecraft. Thank you very much. All right, I'm going to do my number two. You guys ready for this?
Mm.
Here's what I thought about doing with this list. I thought, you know what? Screw this list. I'm just going to pick three adaptations from the same basic source material. Instead, I just went with one of those three. But what I was going to do is...
Wait a minute. Hold on. You already picked your number three.
My number two. But I was going to do three different things. I didn't do this. I was going to do adaptations of Homer, and I was going to talk about how Troy, O Brother, Where Art Thou, and Thin Red Line are all very much adaptations of Homer in their own different ways. I didn't go with...
No one wants to hear that.
I know. No one wants to hear that. So rather than do that, I just picked O Brother, Where Art Thou for how it kind of thumbs its nose at this idea of an adaptation. Because O Brother, Where Art Thou is very loosely modeled after the Odyssey. And there are a few parallels. I mean, it's not really, but I think it starts with a title card from the opening line of the Odyssey. And and, you know, like George Clooney's character's name is Ulysses, and there's the whole thing with, you know, John Goodman with the one eye, it's like a cyclops, and there's sirens in it. And then at the end, George Clooney has to deal with his wife's suitor. So it's not really the Odyssey, but it kind of is, and that's good enough for me for an adaptation. So my number two is O Brother, Where Art Thou, as adapted from Homer's Odyssey.
I like it.
There you go.
Also, Mississippi is kind of our Greece, because it's like the mythic center of the Robert Johnson stuff.
There are, I think one of the characters is named after like a Greek king. Yeah, so.
Leonidas?
Menelaus.
Menelaus.
So there you go.
So that's interesting. You've actually read Homer. I'm impressed.
I love the Iliad. You know that. I'll start talking about the Iliad if you're not careful. I'll talk about the Iliad three times as long as Dingus talked about Stephen King. I will do that. I can do that too.
You want to talk Iliad? I'll talk Iliad.
I'll talk some Iliad like you never heard.
Wow.
All right, Kelly Wand, what is your number two most effective adaptation?
I felt like we spent forever on Misery, so I'm just going to whip through it because my number one's more interesting.
Okay.
This is my least interesting one. It's Dark Knight. And I'll tell you why. I know. But wait, Tom, because it ignored the source material.
Awesome.
In the sense that it didn't give a shit about comic books. It didn't try to look like a comic book. It was all like about, it was its own thing. It walked to its own beat.
Yep.
So Dark Knight, weak.
You know what? I agree. I might steal yours for my number one.
Which one? That? Dark Knight?
Yeah. Because that's another thing. It disregards the source material. It's just this awesome Jonathan Nolan script about, it seems like it was sort of inspired by this idea of Two-Face and the Joker. And it's in a way more like a Greek drama than a comic book. I love that about it. Yep.
It took like infantile tropes of comic books and made them into epic poetry.
And that's the way to do an adaptation. By
debates about human nature and the nature of man, and like Gothamites are part of the plot, like their decision, they have to make a decision. Ugh.
Yeah, and you know how cheesy all that stuff is, like where Spider-Man has to save either the car, the cable car with the innocents in it, or Mary Jane Kopechnik, or whatever her name is. Like, he has to make that decision. And in Dark Knight, it becomes this almost self-contained morality play about the citizens. Batman's got nothing to do with it. I love it.
But he trusts them, and they deserve to be saved. While as the Spider-Man people are always like, yeah, Spider-Man sucks. Fuck
him. In greats.
Yeah. And Dark Knight, see, remember 2008? What a great summer that was. Because Iron Man came out, and then Dark Knight came out. Oh, you didn't like Iron Man. But this summer, A-Team's June?
Yeah, you're right. This has been a great summer.
Yeah, it has. Right. That's my point. A-Team is the Dark Knight of 2010.
Ouch. Wow.
According to two of us, the dumb two. JK. That's my number two. Boring. I'm stuck.
Iron Man 2 is the Iron Man of...
Oh, nice. Sick burn.
Boy, is my face red.
Dingus, what is your number two most effective adaptation? It's from a novel. I know that.
It is from a novel.
Why don't you give us a quote?
I'm not going to give you a quote. I'm just going to let Kelly Wand call me. What are you going to call me?
Nerd?
No, what are you going to call me if I choose something from Lord of the Rings?
A chimp.
Chimp. All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I am a chimp.
Oh, really?
Which one, Two Towers? Was it Two Towers?
Oh.
No, it's going to be Fellowship of the Ring, of course.
That one's the best of the three. That's the most adaptative.
It is the most adaptative-able.
It's the least objectionable adaptation-wise of the three.
So you have no love for the Lord of the Rings films?
I do. I have great love for them. But the second movie irritates me a lot, and I consider a very poor adaptation of the source material.
I find it to be a very interesting adaptation because of how they had to meld the storylines rather than having them be completely separate. But
They changed. It's like the fake Aragorn death. They just added that. That was boring. In this book, Faramir just lets him go. like instantly. I thought that was showed way more character than like the slow, okay, makes them go hundreds of miles out of their way and then lets them go because of some speech Sam makes. I don't like that.
All right, Dingus, what do you got to say to that?
What do you have to say to that?
I have nothing to say to that since I didn't pick that film. I picked Fellowship of the Ring.
That means you don't have to vouch for all three of them?
I really don't, because I'm not...
So that means
about...
you... Okay.
Go ahead, Kelly, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say, does that imply that you consider the second two inferior adaptations?
Yes.
Okay. Really? Okay.
Well, I agree with you.
Certainly. Yeah. I think the first one is a stellar adaptation, and I love all three films, don't get me wrong. I don't think they are as well adapted as the first one is. And I think they go in descending order. I would say the first one is the best. I would say the second one is the second best as far as adaptation, just adapting work. And then third. But I haven't seen the third as many times as I've seen Fellowship of the Ring. And I haven't seen Return of the King as many times because the 15 endings really put me off. And... And while I know that's the one that won Best Picture, I haven't seen it. Maybe I might have only seen it the one time I saw it in the theater, and maybe one time at a bunch of friends got together at Daniel and Darren's house to watch it. And I think I might have only seen it those two times, so I don't really remember that much about it. But the many, many endings of that film really put me off. But Fellowship of the Ring, I think, is a stellar adaptation. And I think it was really hard for me to decide which was going to be one and which was going to be number two on this list. Because I think this film, all three films, but in particular this one, had so much to overcome as far as expectations are concerned. Far more than almost any other group of movies or movie that we can think about as far as adaptations are concerned. Because when you're talking about conquering Lord of the Rings, as far as making an adaptation is concerned, that is a huge mountain to scale. And one of the things I thought about when I was thinking about this list is what do the persons adapting this leave out, and how do they do it? And how do they change it effectively? And Fellowship of the Ring does first of all, obviously it's directed by Peter Jackson. He was one of the writers on it, as was Fran Walsh and Philippa Boyens. And of course, it's based on J.R.R. Tolkien's novels, originally one big work. And how do you adapt that and make everybody happy? Well, there's no way to do that. And so when they were adapting it, they cut things away. And I'm not just talking about cutting away Tom Bombadil, which we've talked about on this podcast before.
Tom's favorite character, by the way.
Oh, I'm so bummed.
Right. But just little things that they had to cut out. Of course, all of the singing and all of the walking. But there's a lot of things they had to cut out, and they had to compress into a couple of hours. And even considering the extended editions, into 3 or 4 hours. It's a tremendous amount to distill based on things that people know so well. They know like the back of their hand. They know these things, and they know these books. More people know these books than a lot of different books. And so adapting this particular novel into one movie and doing it so effectively and getting the world so right, it just overwhelms me. And when I watch this movie, when I get to the point when they're at Rivendell and Frodo says he's going to take the ring, and you see that shot as he says that of Gandalf's face, I can't stop crying. Anytime I see this movie, and it's a goofy Lord of the Rings movie, and I cry every time I see it. At this movie, which is halfway through or about halfway through, at least I think it's where the disc, where you have to change discs, of The Fellowship of the Ring. And I just think this is one of the most effective adaptations of any piece of work ever written. So there you go. That's my number two.
I agree with you, and I actually remember thinking before that movie came out that those movies were going to suck. So when I saw Fellowship of the Ring the first time, I was like, oh. Not only did it not, like, you get to see Sauron fight and Gandalf fight Saruman. That meant a lot to me.
Y'all are so cute. I remember when those movies came out, I did not get them. I was like, what the heck?
Did you see them and not get them, or just not?
Yeah, no, I saw all three of them. I was like, whatever.
He was awesome. He was like, why can't the Nazguls run next to the water? Why do they stop? What are the rules? Fuck you all.
I really did not like those movies. That was.
But now you love them.
Yes, yes, as you know.
Did you read the books, though?
I don't think I've ever gotten all the way through them, no. I mean, I read the first two maybe 2-3 years ago, and I think I might have read them in high school, and somebody ruined – I was reading them in high school, and someone ruined the ending, so I stopped reading.
Whoops, Gollum trips. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I did not care for them at all when they were
– I'm really – here's how gay I am. I consider the Silmarillion better than Lord of the Rings.
Wow. That's hardcore.
That's how gay I am. Because it's you find out a lot. You go, oh, this is why they can't go over water. And there's a lot of fighting and elf warfare and shit. It's great.
When are they going to make a movie of that?
Oh, I'd love that. But you know what bummed me out is in the third one when, remember at the end of Return of the King, the book, where they go back to the Shire and Saruman's there?
Scourging for the scouring of the Shire.
Scouring of the Shire.
Right, right. That's another famous bit, like Tom Bombadil that got left out.
Yeah. But, I mean, why'd they take that out? That's good shit. That would have had that over the 9 endings. That's a good ending. The Hobbits get to fight in the Shire. That's
unlike
badass.
You guys, I have no problem with the things in the movie. I mean, I hate, like, I don't like the, just for dramatic purposes, the fake out where Aragorn gets killed by a war.
No, I hate that. I hate
it. I didn't care for that. But I just overall, the movies are basically my, as an adult, my introduction to the source material. So
I'm just saying, as an adult and a kid, that stuff sounded cool to me. Like, oh, I can't wait to see a movie version of the Hobbits fighting Saruman.
But that was already out. You could see that Ralph Bashke thing.
No. And Tom, what you're talking about actually is a great point for why this is a great adaptation, and the others are very good, but, you know, also very good adaptations, but not as good as this one, is that it makes you not, as far as I'm concerned, it makes you not care. Yeah, and when these were about to come out, I sort of faced a choice. Am I going to read these again? It had been a few years since I'd read them, and I read these books every few years. And so I decided just to not read any of these books until all three movies had come out. And then after the three movies come out, I read them again. And it was a great way to sort of reintroduce myself to these stories and not be so wedded to what is each little thing they're leaving out, which turned out to be a perfect way for me to get introduced to these movies. Because these, when they were adapting it, they must have sort of said, there are certain things we have to leave out, and we're just going to leave them out, and it's too bad if all the people who love these books and the fanboys are going to get mad at us, but we have to leave some things out, and this is what we're leaving out, and too bad.
But that was easiest to do in the first movie, because I think the first book is the best book, and that's the one where the most events happen, and so it was probably the easiest to adapt.
See, that's kind of cute to me, too, to hear you guys talking that way, because, so I saw them in the theaters, didn't care for them. When I finally went back and rewatched them, I rewatched the extended edition basically all over the course of like a day. So in my head, it's all one piece. I don't even really think of them as three separate.
Well, those extended editions are really cool, too, because there's a lot of good.
And that's really a lot.
Death scene, that's in the extended edition.
It's a lot of what helped me, is I really liked some of that extra material in there. Kelly Wan, so I rarely can keep a straight face. Like, I'm not good at playing practical jokes because I'll giggle at them. One of the few instances in my life where I totally punked Dingus was before the third movie came out, I remember he was like a little nervous if it was going to be just as good, and I told him, yeah, I went to a press screening of it, and, you know, I don't really care for the movies. The audience seemed like they were really into it, and they were laughing at how bad some of the dialogue was. I totally sold him on that. I forget how long it took before I actually started giggling, but I totally sold you on that, Dingus.
Did he believe you while he was watching it and go, yeah, you're right, this dialogue sucks?
No.
These olifants are lame. Legolas sliding like a skateboard off the elephant.
I couldn't sustain it. but I did briefly have him worried that the third movie sucked.
Tom, how many hours have you poured into Lord of the Rings Online?
More than I know. Yeah. Mm.
So. Tom can never fool me with his supposed poker face, when he said that about Return of the King, I was crushed. I remember that. I just felt it when he was telling that story. I was so crushed.
I was like,
yeah,
so
specific.
They were laughing at a lot of the dialogue. It was absurd.
They were into it. That's pretty specific. Like, oh, Return of the King. Oh, wait, this Gonberry Gon character. New Jar Jar.
Man, I even forgot that until you told the story. Now I feel bad again, Tom.
Uh-huh.
But then that made you like it even more, because you were like, wait, this is even better than Tom made it sound. So you were like...
Well, eventually, I sussed him out within a few minutes, but that's the longest he's ever been able to hold a poker face, so he had me really crushed for a minute.
That's the thing, is Tom's pranks are so esoteric. They're such weird ideas for pranks that that's part of the trick, is like, why would he line up... Why would he do a whole podcast about how awesome A-Team is? And then three years later go, dude, me and Dinkins totally punked you. We knew it was stupid. And we hate Charlie's Angels, too. Snap.
All right, I'm going to go on to my number one favorite adaptation. Oh, not favorite, most effective adaptation. And it's not an adaptation at all. As anybody who has read The Orchid Thief knows, adaptation is not actually an adaptation. It is a movie about the folly of adaptations, and that right there is as effective as you can be at an adaptation, is acknowledging that adaptations in and of themselves are absurd. So there you go. My number one, the eponymous adaptation.
That's the word for that is metatextual, by the way.
Okay, I'll go with that. Or Kafkaesque. How about Kaufmanesque? Does that work?
Kafkaesque?
Kaufmanesque.
Oh, Kaufmanesque. It's you mean Kaufman, the Invasion of the Bicentric?
So, all right.
My number one's... Wait, is it my turn?
Yep, rock and roll.
This is forever, isn't it? All right, I'm going to go really fast. My number one is another metatextual adaptation, like adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
Naked Lunch. Huh?
Ooh, cool.
Do David Cronenberg and William Burroughs really like? Do they really jibe? Does it seem to fit for you? You don't feel like it betrayed the subject material?
Well, you can't. It's one of those unfilmable books. It did what adaptation did in that it became about a book about the author's life and collected works. It focused on the psychological and moral growth of the protagonist from youth to adulthood creatively.
What is Naked Lunch itself? What is the Burroughs novel about?
And the German word for that process is Bildungsroman.
Right, that's a fun one. What is Naked Lunch? Is Naked Lunch actually a Bildungsroman?
No, it's a bunch of random bullshit. But it's good. I mean, it's a bunch of random psychotic episodes, basically. I mean, there's a guy fleeing from the cops, and then he shoots the cops, and then he finds out they weren't really cops. There's Dr. Benway, who's like Roy Scheider in the movie, who's just like this force for evil, and he makes drugs out of centipede larvae or something.
Wow.
It's a great movie. All right, that's my number one.
Is Peter Weller better in Naked Lunch or in RoboCop?
RoboCop.
It's. Oh. You don't like Naked Lunch, Dingus?
No,
you don't
like
where
I like
he shoots
it.
Judy Davis?
I like it very much.
Oh, and then he has to prove he's a writer by shooting his wife again. Spoiler alert. And he gets high on the insect powder, and he was like a real life.
You know, after we watched Splice, I feel like I need to see an actual Cronenberg movie. This makes me... I want to see The Trial and Naked Lunch again.
The Trial is not Cronenberg.
No, I know. I'm just saying, of your list, Kelly Wand, you've made me want to see two of them, and one of them I already liked and constantly want to re-see anyway. So.
Naked Lunch, I admit to, I think I'm a little biased because it's the only film about writing that I consider good. And so to me, it's like when he's got the typewriter and she's telling him that it's good.
Isn't adaptation about writing?
And yeah, misery. But it's not as good as Naked Lunch. Yeah, Misery's about writing. Well, okay. Those are all good movies. But Naked Lunch is great. That's what
okay.
I guess.
All right.
And my near miss number one was Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Ah, shut up. That's on my... hold on. That might be Dingus's number one, by the way. You're not supposed to... Kelly Wan...
Oh, okay. All right.
All right, Dingus, did Kelly Wan just scoop your number one?
He totally did. I can't believe it.
Because it's from a novel. Fear and Loathing
in Las
Vegas.
He didn't read that. Dingus wouldn't read Fear and Loathing.
His folks wouldn't let him when he was a kid. So, yeah, I can't imagine he was allowed to read that.
That was not a novel. That was an article in Rolling Stone.
But it was, it was a novel. It was a novel. What's wrong with you people?
Oops.
How come you think nothing is a novel? You don't think The Trial's a novel? You just think they're little tiny vignettes because you haven't read them.
Is Dingsy talking to you or to me?
I don't know.
I'm not sure either.
Yeah, David Copperfield.
It's a lesser
suit camp label. Yeah, lesser cuff. All right, number one for Dingus. I have like 9 runner-ups. Spoiler alert. Tom, were there any David Cronenbergs that you haven't seen?
No, I'm pretty sure I've seen all Cronenberg movies.
What to you is the pinnacle of Cronenberg?
I really like how he has matured in History of Violence, but Spider. I really like Spider as well. I like later Cronenberg.
Yeah, I do too.
You know, the early stuff is fine, and it's like a nice sort of subgenre of horror, but I really like where he's ended up.
What's the Viggo Mortensen sauna one?
Eastern Promises.
Eastern Promises. Okay. Dingus
wow, that's
number one.
You know what? That's Cronenberg?
Yeah.
Wow, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Holy cow. Man, look quite wow.
Is there any bad Cronenberg at all?
Some of the early stuff's just so gratuitous and goofy, and I don't think I ever liked Existenz. I don't think that one ever worked for me. That's just like Cronenberg slapdash kind of Cronenbergisms.
That's probably the weakest Cronenberg.
Yeah. I forgot Eastern Promises. What, Madame Purifoy? What did you just say?
Madame Butterfly? Because he's kind of like an opera dude.
Cronenberg did Madame Butterfly?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, am I crazy?
With John Lithgow? Or did I just make that up? Am I crazy?
BD. Click, click.
We're waiting on your number one, Dingus. We'll talk about Cronenberg all night. I can do this all night.
There's always room for Cronenberg.
The Brood remake.
Madame Butterfly, I'm right, 1993, right before Crash, and right after Naked Lunch. It was his follow-up.
Oh, he did Crash? Ouch.
Dead Ringers, The Fly, Dead Zone, Videodrome Scanners, The Brood.
Great, yeah.
Shivers, They Came From Within, the better title. Rabid. Okay, I'll be quiet.
Well, wait,
did you
ever
see Crimes of the Future, his student film, 1970?
I did not. Should I?
Yeah, it's like people eating feet in it, or like licking cream off feet.
That's kind of gross.
No, but it's like, it's part of the process.
All right, Dingus, chime in, get in here. We'll talk about Cronenberg. Is your number one a Cronenberg adaptation?
It is actually not a Cronenberg adaptation.
But it is from a novel.
It is from a novel of the same name.
Is the name of the novel before you tell us the movie?
The novel's name is the titular movie name.
Aha! I know what it is then.
All right, what is it?
It's got boobs in it.
Rushmore. That was good, Kelly Wand. Dingus, get in here, Dingus.
I'm too happy with titular. It's about titty.
Your quote.
Oh, would you like a quote, Kelly Wand?
Yeah, I like your quotes.
All right, you can jump in whenever you're ready. Okay, here we go. You know what you look like to me? You look like a rube. A well-spoken rube with a little taste.
He gave us a gimme after we got so caught up on the misery quote. He's like, these guys are too slow. They're not bright enough. You didn't do
it
the
was crossing?
So.
Yeah. Oh.
That's right. You're a Thomas Harris fan. I forgot about that.
I was until this, until after this book. Yes.
Right. Pre-Hannibal.
You know, like Hannibal, the book?
Hannibal, the book, sucked ass.
Aw, tough room.
Yeah, it is. All right, so, of course, I'm talking about Silence of the Lambs. And this is a 1991 film directed by Jonathan Demme and written by Ted Talley from Thomas Harris's book. And I freaking love this adaptation. And part of this is based on expectations, and part of this, a large part of this category, as it turns out, was about expectations. And I really love how this movie, this film, reaches those adaptations and improves upon the book in a variety of ways. And I was really looking for, I can remember seeing this film for the first time. I can remember having read the book and being so excited about it, because remember, way back in the 1990s, you weren't seeing necessarily movies appearing day and date with books. You would read a book and then have to wait a few years before the movie would actually appear. And I had read Red Dragon, which was the book that came before that, when I was a freshman in college, and a friend of mine, this guy named Pete, had to force me to read it. And I read it and I really liked it. And I read Silence of the Lambs, and we had to wait a couple of years before the movie came out. And I was so excited because I really liked Silence of the Lambs. I think it's a good thriller. It's a really good thriller. And I was really nervous about the movie because movies often, more often than not, do not get it right. And I was so excited about this movie. I was probably quoting the movie before it even came out. And it really fulfilled my expectations, and it exceeded my expectations in a lot of ways. And the best example I can give of this, as far as a movie exceeding the source material or exceeding your expectations, is the quote I was just about to give to you guys, which is, if you look at Hannibal's monologue to Clarice, when he says to her, "You look like a robe, a well-scrubbed hustling robe." If you listen to him delivering that monologue, and then you go and find in the book the monologue that's in the book, and think about what Ted Talley did in paring that down, keeping the essentials and even some of the essential words, but just making it a pared down version of that, that is what this movie is. And this is a brilliant movie. I love this movie. I watched it again this week, of course, and it exceeded my expectations. And also, just as a quick end point to this experience of seeing this movie after being so crazy about wanting to see it and so excited about seeing it and so nervous and scared that it wasn't going to live up to this little book that I liked so much, seeing this movie gave me one of my favorite audience quotes of any movie I've ever seen.
And was she a great big fat person?
No, it was not that. It was an audience quote. So we're sitting there watching the movie. It's a packed theater. It might have been the second time I saw it. And we're at the point in the movie where James Gunn is trying on his woman's suit and dancing for his video camera. and behind me, some woman said, "Whoa, stranger than fiction."
How come everyone says awesome shit when you go to the movies, and I never hear that stuff?
I just get a lot of awesome stuff when I go to the movies.
I get, what does A stand for? What team? Awesome.
All right, so what runners up did you guys have? I almost, this would have been way too obscure, and Dingus would have teased me relentlessly, but I almost chose Bernardo Bertolucci's Sheltering Sky based on Paul Bowles' novel, because I love the novel, and it's one of those unfilmable things you're talking about, Kelly Wand. And I think I love the movie, but I haven't seen it in maybe 5-10 years, so I need to rewatch it again, because Dingus says it.
It's my number one, though, Naked Lunch. I saw it 30 years ago.
Other runner-ups did you guys have? Dern Loaded in Las Vegas, that was certainly one, yeah.
I really like the adaptation that I just like the difference that Blade Runner is to Android's Dream of Electric Shape. I like the way that adaptation goes. It's a different world, but that world totally works.
Mm-hmm. Tom would know that because he hasn't read that book or seen that movie.
Well, that's not even that's a short story, isn't it?
It's actually just a sentence. Do androids change? But
that is the story. Yeah.
That goes unanswered, by the way, that question. I had Requiem for a Dream, but I didn't pick it because I hadn't read the book. or the short story, mm-hmm. or whatever the hell it was. And you know what else I thought of, which I didn't put because I thought you guys would laugh at me too hard? The Brady Bunch movie. Because that was the first, that was like the first like TV series to movie thing where they totally made fun of the source material, which to me was quite groundbreaking at the time. Mm. And then, I mean, you know, it kind of jumped the shark with the second one where they go to Hawaii. But
there are two Brady Bunch movies?
Yeah.
Good Lord.
A very Brady sequel. Also, Zap 2 is an adaptation. Also, right. The Bible is not a good adaptation of the Bible because it only covers like the first three pages.
Yeah, there's a lot. They had to cut a lot out of that one there. All right, are you guys ready for next week's 3x3? Because Kelly Wand, you're going to love this one.
Mm.
Takes a little bit of setup. Mm. Kelly Wand, have you seen that Harold and Kumar movie, the first one?
Hell yeah.
So you know the scene, there's like the two hot chicks, and then they go into the bathroom, and it's all gross. You know what I'm talking about?
No. I don't remember that part.
Maybe it's in the second one.
I the second one.
In one of the Harold and Kumar movies, they meet, they go to a school, I'm pretty sure it's the first one, and they meet these really two hot chicks. And then there's a scene of the two hot chicks in the restroom, in the stalls, doing business, and it's really, like, gross. It's like a gross-out thing. That's not ringing any bells, Kelly Wand?
With hot girls?
Yeah. See, that's the irony of it there. See, hot chicks.
I don't like those combos.
Yeah, good. I don't either. So instead, because see, my 3x3 are scenes in bathrooms, but instead, I want to tell you about three scenes that I'm thinking of. So these will be taken off the table. The Harold and Kumar one, that's not what I'm looking for. Instead, I'm thinking of in Bring It On, there's a really cute scene where Kirsten Dunst and Jesse Bradford are flirting while they're brushing their teeth. It's in a bathroom. It's very innocent. It's very cute. In Witness, there's the scene where Lucas Haas escapes by like diving under the little dividers in the restroom. Close Encounters of the Third Kind. You know, Richard Dreyfuss is brushing his teeth, and the kids come up behind him with a ping pong paddle, and they smack him on the butt, and he turns around, and that's when you get the reveal that he's been half sunburned, and they take a picture of him because he's been half sunburned, and they say he looks like a 50-50 bar. So what I want from you guys are three restroom scenes that aren't gross.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, see?
That aren't gross.
Exactly.
By your standards, or?
You know what? Apply your own standards.
By Cronenberg's standards.
And I'm specifically, it's already my number one. I'm thinking of one particular scene it's a fantastic bathroom scene. I don't even think you guys have seen the movie. So here's what I've been doing for my 3x3 is I think of a movie I want to talk about, and I arrange the list around the movie. So one particular movie's inspired this, but what I want from you guys are three restroom scenes that aren't gross. Mm. And I've taken Witness, Close Encounters, and Bring It On off the table because I think those are examples. Mm. So there you go. See what you can come up with for that.
Dingus, what do you think of that list?
If there's anything else he wants to take off the table. Because I've got one that I really love.
What is it? And I'll take it off the table.
I can't speak that language, so I'm not going to tell you.
Is it in Klingon?
Swahili?
All right, so there you go. Think about that for the week. Next week we will be seeing Toy Story 3, optionally in 3D, I believe. So come on back. We'll spoil Toy Story 3 for you. I am Tom Chick. I am joined by Christian McCready.
Christian Murawski.
Oh, I was close. It's like McCready.
It's very close. I'm from Simon & Simon.
And also Kelly Wand. We'll be right back. Oh, no, I lost it. Oh, whatever you're playing, save that. Something happened where we stopped recording at some point. I wasn't even touching the computer. I quickly hit record again, so I don't think we lost anything.
Wait, but after...
See, you had your fun, but a darling catch...
Oops, it was right before I announced the 3x3. Yeah, it was... Dingus had finished talking about Silence of the Lambs, and we were talking, I think, about Runners Up. And I saw the little window shrink. It stopped recording. I just reached over and hit record. So.